And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usry, and my guest today is Nick Petrie. Nick earned his MFA from the University of Washington and is known for a series of thrillers starring veteran Peter Ashe. The first three were The Drifter, Burning Bright, and Light It Up. And today we'll be talking about the fourth installment, Tear It Down, which is published by G.P. Putnam Sons. Peter Ashe has quite a history before Tear It Down and even the first three books in the series. He's a veteran, and he's had a hard time readjusting to civilian life. Where and when did he serve, and what kind of difficulties is he having getting back into civilian life?
Well, Peter signed up, like a lot of our vets did, after 9/11, and so he got sent to Afghanistan first and then Iraq, and he was in the Marines for 8 years total. And the challenges he's having, again, like a lot of the vets I've talked to, is post-traumatic stress that takes the form of claustrophobia, so it's hard for him to be inside for a long period of time, and it's hard to have a real life and get a real job and to do those things if you can get a panic attack every time you go indoors. So those are sort of the challenges that he's facing.
And in a previous book, the dense forest was even enough to set off his claustrophobia.
That's right. Yeah, that's the second book, Burning Bright, takes place on the west coast of California and all the way up through to Seattle.
And that's where he met June Cassidy.
That's right, his sweet patootie. I don't know, I guess it's sort of a meet cute, you could say, but she's on the run from some bad people, and Peter, as is his usual mode, is trying to be useful, and he steps in, and the best thing about June is that she is more than a match for him, and I think that was important when you have a strong character to have a partner who can share those strengths and isn't sort of scared off by those strengths. Like I've met so many military spouses who are truly astonishing.
We know his strengths and his weaknesses dealing with the PTSD. Was it the white static?
Right.
He calls it, but you can't have a perfect character with June. What are some of her drawbacks? What are some of her weaknesses?
Well, she's a little impatient and sometimes a little too strong for her own good. So like most people, sometimes she pushes a little too much to try to make something happen. I'm not sure June has a whole lot of weaknesses.
Or at least flaws.
Well, she certainly swears a lot, like the other women in my life. I was raised by a strong woman. I'm married to a strong woman. My sister and my sister-in-law are both quite forceful, substantial people. So I think, especially women today, they can't have it both ways, right? To be a strong woman and to stand up for yourself and the things you believe in, to stand up for your family, to stand up for the people you work for or work with. But at the same time, there's often pushback. So it's, you know, men are strong and women are bossy, right? So it's a perception thing. So I think strong women are always, there's always a little bit of pushback.
Now, in Tear It Down, they have found an arrangement that has been working for a few months. In fact, it's the longest Peter has stayed any place since he's back into the States.
They are crazy about each other and they're committed to each other, but it really is hard for Peter to sort of stay settled. And that's something that I decided early on in the series, is that each book was going to take place in a different location. And it works for me as a writer because it helps keep me from getting bored. And I'm really interested in setting and place, and it lets me really develop each book with a different setting. And I think it helps the books feel unique. But, you know, I've talked to lots of vets, and let me point out here, I am not a veteran, so this is all of my information about veterans comes from conversations with veterans, and I've spent, you know, hours and hours talking with vets about their lives now, kind of after the war. But, you know, that kind of restlessness is real common, where it's hard to sit still when you have been, you know, kind of living at a fast rate of speed, deployed overseas and then deployed home and back overseas. I know vets who have, you know, were deployed, you know, seven or eight times. And that restlessness is real, and it can be really hard to sort of slow down, because if you slow down, you start to think about some of the things you've been through.
During this time, Peter's been putting his carpentry skills to use. What has he been doing?
Well, again, it's part of that inability to sit still. So Peter grew up in northern Wisconsin, and his dad was a contractor, and so he was always spent, you know, summers and working after school with his dad. You know, he likes to be useful, so he's always trying to fix stuff. So when he's in the valley where June lives, he's working on all the outbuildings, so a new roof on the equipment shed and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And in Tear It Down in Memphis, he goes to help Wanda Wyatt, who's being harassed, and by the time he actually arrives in Memphis, someone's driven a dump truck through her front door. So he's got to stabilize the house and then work on getting it put back together.
Where did he acquire his carpentry skills?
Oh, from his dad. So a part of it's just the things that you're kind of, that are in the air growing up. you know, it was his summer job for a long, long time. And I actually, that's not too dissimilar from me. My dad wasn't a contractor, but my dad was always doing projects around the house. So I was always the kid who got to hold the other end of the piece of plywood, running it through the table saw, or, you know, fixing this or that that my dad couldn't get around to. My dad was big on painting and patching plaster, so I learned those skills early on as well.
Did you and your siblings put a lot of holes in the plaster?
My older brother and older sister raised a lot more hell than I did, let me just put it that way. I was a carpenter, and I ran a remodeling business, and then I was a home inspector. So I've done pretty much everything you can do to a house. I took a house on a crawl space and picked it up and put a basement underneath, and I took a one-story house and turned it into a two-story house. Of course, don't come look at the house that I live in, because you know what they say about the shoemaker's children who have no shoes.
Now, before the interview, you mentioned that you haven't made a piece of furniture in a while, but you also made furniture, it seems.
When we put an addition on a house, and the, you know, the homeowner would say, boy, you know, we're looking for just the right kitchen table or dining room table, or we're looking for the right bookcase to put here, and we just can't find them when we like, then we would say, well, let's draw one together and we'll find one that works for you. So I built all kinds of stuff, and I built, oh my goodness, I can't tell you how many kitchens. And I love doing casework like that, just because there's something very pleasing about working in the shop. Most of my time as a carpenter and contractor was spent out in other people's homes. So it was always a treat to work in the shop, you know, which was kind of my space, and to see things be created before your eyes. I really do miss making stuff. I need to get back to that, because it's good therapy.
Do you have a similar sense of accomplishment when you finish a book as you do when you'd finish a really big project, or are there different feelings?
There are different feelings. Finishing a book is accomplishment, but also a huge sense of relief that I can then pass it on to my editor, and I let her kind of chew it up and spit it out again. I mean, it takes a year to write a book for me. So I've never done a remodeling project that took that long. A long project is, you know, 4 months or 6 months to replace somebody's kitchen or to put on an addition. So it actually takes me longer to write a book than it ever took me to do a building project. So it's a larger sense, but yeah, mostly relief.
So has the one-a-year schedule been good for you, or do you feel a little stressed by it, or?
A little bit of both. You know, a deadline does sort of keep you moving. What I have learned is that really that first decision for me seems to often be the best decision. So I've done projects where the character is going to do a certain thing and I write that section and then I realize, you know, okay, maybe not. Let's try this. So then I try four or five more iterations and I just invariably seem to come back around to that first decision. So I'm just, you know, second guessing myself all the way around. So when the clock is ticking, you really don't have that luxury to make, you know, to second guess, and you just keep moving forward. And so I do like that part of it very much, but there's really not a lot of rest for the wicked. Honestly, I work 7 days a week most weeks. I work full days. I am not a fast writer, not like some I know. I wish I could be a faster writer, but it sort of is what it is.
How does your family feel about contractor Nick and then writer Nick? Who do they prefer?
That's a good question. Well, they're both stressful in different ways. Being a contractor, at least there is, you know, when you're building a deck or you're building a kitchen, there's a set of steps. And you know, if you do the first step, then you can move to the second step and then the third step. It's a very, for me anyway, it was a very sort of orderly process. And I had been doing all of it long enough that it wasn't that I could do it in my sleep, but I just was very comfortable doing it. So Tear It Down is the fourth book I've published, and I'm very proud of this book, but it still feels like I'm kind of making it up as I go along. And so maybe by the time I get to the sixth book or the seventh book or the eighth book, I'll start to feel a little more settled, except that every writer I've talked to who, you know, has been doing this for a long time kind of says, you know, it really doesn't get easier. And in my experience, it hasn't gotten easier. It's actually gotten harder, because those first couple of books, you can really rely on your instincts in a certain way, sort of those natural moves that you make. But as the books go farther along, you really have to sort of decide, you know, well, let's say I've already done X, Y, and Z, so now where do I have to find something else that is maybe not such a natural thing for me to try. You know, it becomes a little more difficult. And the series isn't long enough that I can start to sort of pull in characters necessarily that aren't continuing characters that I can't loop in back around. So there's a character in Tear It Down named Eli Bell, who's a young street musician, and he's a character who I really like, and I would love to see him come back in a future book, but I've got to wait, you know, 5 or 10 years to have that book happen. So I'm sort of planting seeds in a way for at some point in the future to have some of these characters that I really don't want to let go of come back.
Yeah, seeing Eli on tour in about 10 years would be a great thing.
Well, that could be the Peter Ash comes to LA, right? And it would be this young street kid who has sort of made it big, and kind of it would be a whole different set of problems. But we have to wait a little while for that to happen.
Now you mentioned 4 published books. Are there any unpublished ones other than the one that might come out next year that are sitting in your drawers?
Well, no, I wrote 3 books I couldn't get published before my first book, The Drifter, came out. And that's not an unusual state of affairs. In part, I'm kind of a slow learner, I think. But, you know, this is not something that is particularly easy to do. There are those writers who I particularly don't like who, you know, their first book comes out at the age of 21. Of course, they're terribly talented, but that doesn't mean I have to like it. Whereas for me, my first book came out when I was 47. And again, the average first age of publication, I think, is somewhere around 40. You need some life experience and you need some practice for most people to do this. So I wrote 3 books that weren't good enough to publish.
I saw that you have an MFA from University of Washington. How helpful was that process going through the MFA program?
The best thing I got from that program was that it was really this little island of space and time and people with whom I could work, for whom it was really important, you know, words. I mean, whether they're poets or short story writers, but where the telling of stories and how words work was really important. And that was really valuable to me. But it was a kind of a program, and I still talk to people who are in the program. I still talk to some of my old professors. But I didn't know then that I would be doing this now, that I'd be writing, you know, crime fiction. But even then, my work was a little too commercial for, you know, I think in the world of the MFA that their goal is to have you turn out the perfect New Yorker story, which is, I like those stories, but it's not really what I'm interested in writing. I like stories where things happen. I like stories with real plots and, you know, if there's a little gunplay and somebody gets beat up, well, I like that too.
So what do you think has drawn you to crime fiction? Why do you enjoy writing it?
Well, I grew up reading all kinds of stuff, but I grew up reading John D. MacDonald and Gregory MacDonald, the Fletch books I really liked, the early Spencer stuff, Robert Parker's early stuff especially really speaks to me. You know, both my parents read crime fiction, you know, Chandler and Hammett and all that good stuff. So in part, it's just been in the air. What some people think of as literary fiction, I mean, this is, we were talking earlier about Cormac McCarthy and the Border Trilogy, the book All the Pretty Horses, which won the National Book Award, which was hailed as a, you know, literary tour de force. But for me, the revelation of that book is that it's a cowboy novel, right? This is Louis L'Amour. If Louis L'Amour was really, really good at what he did, right, he might have produced something like All the Pretty Horses. This is the cowboy novel elevated to sort of the utmost. And to me, what I got out of that was that anything can be beautiful. The genre is unimportant and that all the barriers are down. And just write what you want to write and tell an interesting story in an interesting way. And the rest of it is irrelevant. I mean, that's kind of what I try to do. I want to write something that captures you. I want to write something that certainly moves quickly. I love books that, you know, I just want to keep turning the pages. But I want characters that you're really going to care about. I want there to be some real emotion. I want there to be consequences. I read all kinds of stuff. But I want a story where you get lost and you kind of fall in love with those people. That's kind of what I'm trying to do.
Now, there are a lot of moving parts in the story, and we'll get to them in due course. But why did June send Peter to Memphis?
Again, Peter is kind of restless in June's place in Washington State. And she knows that he's getting antsy, and she, you know, is trying to sort of help him kind of scratch that itch to go off and be useful, as Peter says. So her friend Wanda has been having trouble. She's been being harassed. And so Peter hops in his truck and drives to Memphis because he's claustrophobic, so he doesn't fly, obviously. But by the time he gets there, somebody has driven a dump truck through Wanda's living room, and Peter's got to figure out kind of who did it and why. And of course, he gets into much more than he bargains for, and June ends up a little upset at him because, you know, hey, Peter's all in. I mean, he's just that kind of guy.
Yeah, but she's the one that sent him there in the first place.
Well, yes, but, you know, I have arguments with my wife, and those aren't always terribly rational, those arguments. So, but it was a chance for me to tell a fun story in a cool place like Memphis.
Now, Wanda seems like kind of a stereotypical artistic type. She's not very ordered. She's got kind of a sloppy house. But Peter finds out that it's just not the artist in her, that she's been a conflict photographer and she's seen almost as much bad stuff as he has.
That was part of what I was trying to do with this book, was to show sort of the other ways that post-traumatic stress, the other reasons why it can show up in people's lives. And so conflict photographers often have some of those same symptoms. And Eli Bell, this street kid, is actually also shows some of those symptoms. There's a great radio piece on Chicago Public Radio about, and you know, Chicago has this huge gang violence problem, obviously, like a lot of cities do. So somebody was talking about how street kids show all the same symptoms of post-traumatic stress that combat veterans do because they're under all of the same stresses. There is no safe place. The streets, their homes, their, you know, violence is random. You know, kids at the age of 12 can get attacked on the way to school, on the way home from school. And I was trying to sort of plug in some of these other ways that this kind of stuff happens. The other thing you talked about, the moving parts in this book, the other thing I'd never done before was to tell a story with these two parallel storylines. And I always sort of give myself a challenge for every book. So what am I going to sort of try to do that's technically different from something I've done before? And for me, that was the challenge I'd set myself, was how to tell these two parallel storylines and kind of braid them together in such a way that it sort of unified into something. I don't know, I've never written something quite so complex, but I'm getting fine reviews and people keep turning the pages. So
Peter gets there, tries to control the situation a little bit, see what's going on, and he climbs under the house to see what kind of structural damage has been done to the foundation and finds out there's a very weird foundation for this house.
The center post for the center beam of this house is an old tree stump. I did a big kitchen renovation on a house in Seattle. It was built in 1904, I think, where one whole corner of the house was sitting on this massive tree stump that was just, they weren't using hydraulic equipment. There was no backhoe. These were, you know, human beings digging these foundations. And, you know, rather than remove this massive tree trunk, they just used it to carry a corner of the house. I've been in more basements and crawl spaces than I ever care to remember. And people do all kinds of creative things, especially in really old houses. But that's also kind of part of the themes that are running through this book is all of the ways in which Memphians are tied to Memphis and are tied to where they live. That was just something that kind of, and of course, as I write, I think about this stuff afterwards. The tree stump just showed up. It was only after I had written the first draft that I thought, I wonder why I put that tree stump in there.
Well, and there's all these histories that are affecting the current day that go back 150 years, but there is history affecting people every single day in this book.
You know, the way that I work, I wish I could work from an outline because I think that might be a simpler process, but that doesn't seem to be how it works for me. So I start writing at the beginning of a book and I just write forward until I get to the end. And there are, you know, false starts and false turns and, you know, I hit the delete key quite a lot. It's not a very efficient process, but it seems to be what works for me. And it's not until I really get to the end of that first draft that I can sort of see it as a whole and sort of say, So I guess that's kind of what I'm doing in this book. So I didn't deliberately have these multiple histories show up in this book. They just came into my mind and it seemed to be right and I kept writing forward. But then, you know, I get to the end and suddenly I can have a little more perspective. And I think, okay, this fits. Oh, maybe I need to take something out or bring something forward to give it a little more life. It's an interesting and strange process. Again, it's not at all like building a house where, you know, I move from step A to step B to step C. There's a lot of circular writing.
Well, and I like the way that you played against kind of tropes in crime fiction because he starts to deal with someone from the Memphis police force, Detective Gantry. And instead of being this pugnacious guy that doesn't want him interfering, he's pretty laissez-faire. He says, hey, if you figure anything out, you can tell me about it too.
I've spoken with a lot of police as well. And there's a definite attitude about, you know, hey, we are in charge here. You know, this is our city and we are, you know, to serve and protect. It's all, you know, I think a lot of people think about it that way. But especially in cities like the city where I live, Milwaukee, and I think that's true of Memphis as well, where, you know, budgetary issues are huge. And if somebody wants to be of use and it's sort of outside the purview of the cops, well, you know, sure, we'll take all the help we can get.
Now, why did you choose Memphis as the setting for the story?
That's actually a funny story. So I had planned this book as much as I plan any book, but I thought that this would be sort of a natural disaster book, and I was going to have the New Madrid fault. I thought there would be the, you know, the giant earthquake that the area has been waiting for the last 150 years. And so I kind of set this thing in motion, but these characters, these Memphis characters, and I picked Memphis because Memphis has this great history, and I wanted to play with some of that history, and I wanted to include some of the great music that came out of Memphis as well. And so this was, you know, every book should have kind of its own flavor, I think. So rather than set it on the West Coast or someplace like that, But then these characters just kept sort of bumping into each other and new things kept happening. And before I knew it, I was writing a book that was definitely not going to have an earthquake in it. Of course, my editor asked me before I started, so what's this next book going to be? It's going to be set in Memphis and there's going to be an earthquake. Oh, she said, that'll be great. And of course, I delivered a book that's set in Memphis with no earthquake in sight. It's just got these characters all sort of, you know, playing off each other. And I delivered and she just said, hey, this is great. So I'm very lucky actually to have an editor who kind of lets me do whatever shows up.
Now, you talked about the interweaving storylines, and the beginning of the book isn't even about Peter and June. It starts off in Memphis, and we have a young man named Eli who is homeless and squatting in an abandoned house with three other young men. What's their situation like there? They're teenagers.
They're teenagers. The oldest of them is 15 years old, and they have, like happens often in certain parts of certain cities, where there's really no one left to care for them, and there's no social system left in place to, you know, kind of keep them fed and sheltered. And if there is, they don't want any part of it. So three of these kids are in some way or another being supported as part of this criminal enterprise. And the fourth, Eli Bell, doesn't want to be connected to that either. He wants to make his own way for reasons that will become clear when you read the book. And so he's playing guitar and singing for tips on the street or when he can, you know, in a club. And so he's just trying to kind of make his way forward, except the three other kids sort of hatch a plan and he kind of gets dragged into it. Not unwillingly, but it comes about in a way that I think happens a lot to young men. It's that, well, you know, your friends start to hatch something and you know, either you're either with your friends or you're not with your friends. And I think for especially when your friends are your support system, you know, it's hard to make that choice.
It reminded me just a touch of Five Against the House, the 50s crime film where a bunch of college kids are in Reno and the cop says casinos can't be robbed. So they hatch up almost an intellectual plan to rob a casino. Then it actually goes through with it.
I don't know that film. I should check
Brian
it out.
Brian Keith plays a really unhinged Korean vet in that one, and things go really bad. I think Kim Novak is in it too.
Okay, that's worth checking out.
It's a fabulous little film.
Yeah, Five Against the House?
Yeah.
All right.
They decide they're going to knock over a jewelry store in the Wolf Chase Galleria Mall, which is the big suburban mall in Memphis.
When I was researching Memphis before I started this, I realized there was this whole string of smash and grab jewelry store robberies. So that was kind of what gave me the idea for this scene. And so the plan is to go in and break the glass and steal diamond rings and expensive watches. And Eli is actually the planner. Eli is sort of the intellectual of the group. They have an elaborate plan for basically harvesting some jewelry, and then they've already kind of figured out where they're going to sell it and who they're going to sell it to. But then, of course, nothing goes to plan. And, you know, what happens is a little heartbreaking. At least that's my goal, is to sort of tug on people's heartstrings a little bit, even these young kids who are doing wrong, to have you feel what they feel in the process.
There's only a couple of characters that don't get our sympathy in the book.
That's good. I'm really interested in – I don't believe in people who are all good or all bad. I'm interested in the gray areas. I'm interested in complicated, complex characters that are going to – you know, everybody has their own motivations. One of my favorite lines for writers is that even the villains are the heroes of their own stories. And I think of that all the time when I'm writing characters, because – even characters who are ostensibly good, you know, don't always have the best of motivations. And characters who are bad, well, they, you know, they have their reasons too. I like to have characters to be, you know, full of that, you know, kind of real human conflict internally as well.
Peter goes out trying to do some recon and get some equipment ready for the rehab job at Wanda's place and stops to get some gas.
Well, that actually came by from reading the news as well, where there are people who had been hijacked at gas stations. And so this is how Peter and Eli meet. So Eli is desperate after this jewelry store heist goes bad, and Peter happens to be gassing up his 1968 Chevrolet pickup truck. And Peter finds himself admiring this young stick-up kid and also kind of seeing the desperation in him. He knows something's gone wrong. And so Peter has certainly the skills and the resources to stop this, but instead he decides he doesn't want to hurt this kid. So he lets Eli take his truck, which I know I'm going to hear about from readers, because readers are actually very attached to Peter's pickup truck. It's also kind of his only home, really. He lives out of it for the first three books.
And he has that wonderfully finished tool kit area in the back.
That's right. That's right. He's put a lot of time. It was a barn find in California, so he's restored it. He's built this mahogany cap on the back and filled it with custom toolboxes. So it's a hard thing to let go. But, you know, things are things and people are people. People are more important to Peter than things.
Why did you choose a 68 Chevy pickup for him?
Very personal reasons. When I was living in Ann Arbor, Michigan, my first job in the building trades was as a roofer's helper, which is not an elevated position. Let's just say.
You had to use the magnet, go around picking up the nails afterwards?
Yeah, set the ladders, use the magnet. I spent a lot of time carrying shingles up ladders. But the roofer I worked for, there were also two carpenters who worked for him. And Andy Beezer in Ann Arbor, Michigan, had this beautiful bottle green 1968 Chevy pickup truck that every once in a while I got to drive. And it was the first time I'd really driven something that was – it wasn't old. It was really vintage. And it had been beautifully restored. A friend of theirs was in the – basically the car rescue business and had restored this truck. And it was, you know, it was the pride and joy. And he actually let me drive it as a 20-year-old idiot kid. Clearly, I still have fond thoughts about that truck.
Was it three in the tree or four on the floor?
That was actually an automatic.
Oh, wow.
But I also had a friend who had a 1969 – Ford pickup truck that was three on the tree, which was a blast to drive. And that truck, the body wasn't actually attached to the chassis. His dad was in mid-restoration, and the whole thing was resting on 4x4s that were spread across the chassis. And so every time you like went over the railroad tracks, the whole truck would sort of separate and then come back together. And so driving that truck, I mean, it's just the whole thing felt like it was just, you know, loose. That was a blast to drive as well. But the green Chevy was my first, so...
My father had a 72 Cheyenne.
Oh, there you go.
And it had what I call mystery steering. It had about 40, 50 degrees of play. At some point, the steering would kick in.
Yep. Well, those old trucks there, you know, it's kind of a work of art.
The gas station clerk is a zero help to him and tells him to go down the street to make a phone call. And the kindest people in the world just offer to give him a ride.
They do. They are the nicest people in Memphis. Yeah, Peter bumps into a guy in a big black Mercedes who is really sort of helpful. And it turns out I don't want to quite give away too much here, but it turns out that the man in the black Mercedes has another reason for looking for the kid who stole Peter's pickup truck. So they go look together until there's yet another distraction sort of shows up.
We could say there's another bit of white static that comes into Peter's life.
There is. I had so much fun writing this book. I had so much fun sort of imagining what terrible things to do to my characters. I have readers who say, now why can't Peter and June just sort of settle down and maybe June should get pregnant and they could have a kid and, you know, that would be wonderful, but it wouldn't be the kind of story that I write. It would not be a fascinating crime story to have Peter be well-adjusted and happy. So, you know, I have to keep putting Peter through some things. In this book, there's almost a return to Peter's combat experience in Iraq, and my goal is to kind of push those buttons a little bit because he is starting to get a little comfortable with it. He's working his way through his post-traumatic stress, and as a writer, it wouldn't do to get him too comfortable.
Can we talk about Judah and Albert?
Sure.
Judah Albert Burkitts are a couple of guys from northern Mississippi. They're brothers, but they couldn't be less alike.
Albert is the responsible one. He's kind of a hard luck case, never really made it through high school. Got a job at the Toyota plant in southern Mississippi, but he's living on the family farm and he's injured when he rolls the antique tractor that he's driving. And the farm is really the thing that gives him the most pleasure in life. But so because he damages his hip from rolling the tractor, he loses his job at the Toyota plant. And so he's kind of hanging on with his fingernails. He hatches this plan to start up a meat processing facility, except he can't quite manage the legal piece of it, which is to get this place in compliance with state code for a meat processing plant. He's borrowed against the farm. And so, you know, he's up against things. But Judah Lee, his little brother, is really kind of the bad seed of the family who was just kind of never quite right, who manages to get himself sent off to prison. And then he comes home and he thinks he knows how to help get back taxes paid off on the farm and to reclaim their heritage. And of course, everything goes terribly wrong.
It's not a typical meat processing. Albert is a wild hog eradicator. How did that idea come to you and how did you do the research for it?
I have no idea how that idea came to me. I kind of research as I go and it's part procrastination and part just sort of trying to dive a little deeper into the world. So, you know, I was reading the Memphis Commercial Appeal online and it must have been an ad or something that I clicked on. And suddenly I'm in this world of infrared wildlife cameras and people who you pay to trap and eradicate the wild hogs that are tearing up your hobby farm or, you know, your home garden or whatever else. And I thought that would be a great way to meet Albert, would be at his sort of at work trying to kill these hogs that he's trapped. And you see a little bit about, again, we're talking about characters who aren't all one thing. You know, it's an interesting way to meet a character. And then his brother Judah Lee shows up and we see the same scene sort of taken in a different direction. And so it's a good way to contrast those two characters.
People don't realize that if a domestic pig that's set up for butchering escapes out in the wild, in just two or three generations, they revert back to full wild boar.
Oh, absolutely.
Pigs,
absolutely.
They're dangerous as all get out.
They're super smart and they do a huge amount of damage to the forests, to crops, breed like crazy. They're spreading throughout the Southeast and Texas, and it's a real problem. But the other thing is that if you have a legal meat processing facility, you can capture them and sell organic pork. So, you know, if you want some really good barbecue, you know, wild feral pig makes a really nice whatever floats your boat, you know.
So we've just kind of barely scratched the surface of all that's going on in this book. And I'm really happy that we didn't give away too much of the story, because there is a lot that goes on.
You know, the expression less is more. I am a believer in more is more. I want there to be a lot going on and to kind of keep people entertained. I always like books where I learn something. So the goal is always to, for me, in the course of writing, to learn something and then to sort of share some of the stranger aspects of the world with my readers.
I'm definitely going to be driving on the interstate just a little bit more carefully nowadays. So have you already finished the book for next year?
I am editing it right now. As soon as I get off the road, I'm going to be tearing into it substantially. So that's kind of my next big project, is to get back to that.
Well, Nick, I want to thank you so much for stopping by today. It's been a lot of fun.
Oh, thanks, Steve. I appreciate you having me. I always love these conversations.
Nick Petrie is the author of Tear It Down, the fourth installment of the Peter Ashe series, published by G.P. Putnam Sons. I'm Stephen Usry, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WYPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.